But first, Richard Poplack. Poplack was born in Johannesburg, South Africa. He emigrated to Canada with his family shortly before Nelson Mandela's release from prison in 1990. Poplack is the author of The Sheik's Batmobile, In Pursuit of American Pop Culture in the Muslim World. He told Anne Strainchamps what inspired him to write the book.
I learned about an Arabization of The Simpsons. So, and this is sort of what sparked the idea for me. I was in Johannesburg working, doing the usual surfing on the internet, and came across the story that The Simpsons had been not just translated or dubbed into Arabic, but literally Arabized, which I guess could be termed reculturating for a conservative audience, specifically a Saudi audience.
What does it mean to Arabize The Simpsons?
Well, it means to make sure that Homer, or now Omar Shamshoon, does not drink Duff beer. He drinks Duff soda, or a kind of a juice. He doesn't eat bacon, of course. Rabbi Krestovsky is no longer with us. Those sort of things. So literally excising anything that could be termed offensive to, you know, your average fundamentalist.
And is Omar Simpson, is he still an American? Is this still a sitcom about an American family? Or has the Simpson family, all of them, now been transplanted to a mythical Arabic country?
Well, this is the absurd thing. The guy who Arabized The Simpsons is a brilliant Egyptian poet and a very, very funny and brilliant man named Amr Hosni. And he insisted that what he terms the sheikhs at NBC, which was a satellite television station that commissioned his work, he insisted that they do not remove the Shamshoons, who are the Arab Simpsons, from America. Nope, this takes place in some weird version of America.
How does that play out then? I mean, are all of, is the Shamshoon
poorly.
Family, poorly, is the Shamshoon family an Arabic family just that happens to be plunked down in, you know, Springfield, Ohio, or wherever they are?
It's just some weird Saudi-mandated version of what America is viewed through the lens of yellow people running around the place. Amr Hosni was tearing his hair out about this. He felt that he had a great opportunity. He loves the original The Simpsons. He thinks it's a brilliant show and had a lot to speak to Arab audiences if he had just been allowed to dub it properly. But nope, they wouldn't allow him to do that.
You must have watched some episodes of Al Shamshoon.
I did, yeah.
What's it like?
It's terrible. It's very, very flat. The voice work is indifferent. It doesn't make any sense. My Arabic is very poor, but Amr was translating it for me. And yeah, or the jokes don't work.
So it really bombed?
Oh, it bombed huge, yeah.
Why did anybody think that Arab viewers would like an Arabized version of The Simpsons to begin with? The Simpsons is a very satirical take on American culture filled with a lot of almost in-jokes. What made network executives think this would play in the Arab world?
Well, despite what a lot of Arab intellectuals will say, at least the Egyptian dialogue fits enormously well with American humor. There's the same sort of level of sarcasm, the same biting satire. The show could have worked quite successfully, and a number of similar products have. But I think what excited the Saudi executives at NBC about The Simpsons is that, and brilliantly so, it's a product. It's something that they could endlessly milk. There's 22 seasons, I think, at this point, of The Simpsons, plus a movie. It could have been an endless cash cow for them. All they do is Arabize and Arabize and Arabize, and boom, they're set for 22 years. I think it looked enormously attractive to them from that point of view. They just insisted on making sure that it offended absolutely no one, and that's obviously where they went wrong.
So are there a lot of young people in the Middle East who are obsessed with, heavily involved with North American pop culture?
As far as my travels would lead me to believe, I think that's definitely the case. How they're obsessed and how they're involved is what's interesting to me. The obsession is at once healthy and at once unhealthy. But it also, I think one starts digging through the cultural roots, there's some very, very surprising connections. I'm thinking here specifically about my time in the Palestinian territories and in Gaza, where I was looking at hip-hop and how hip-hop has become, again, a very specific Palestinian cultural product. And how the hip-hop heads there, who are in every way obsessed with hip-hop, have made it their own. But there are also links, very specific links, between American hip-hop and Palestinian hip-hop.
How do the politics of this play? Because you would think that young, political, edgy Palestinians would not want to adopt anything American.
The politics play out very, very queasily. Yeah, there are all sorts of levels of complications with regard to, especially with regard to hip-hop in Palestine. And a lot of the guys who started rapping are quite insistent that this is not an American art form. Although it was sort of started by black Americans, or at least popularized by black Americans in the Bronx and in New York during the 70s and the 80s, it's a traditional Arabic form of music. If you listen to the Quran, the cadences are very similar. There's obviously links between hip-hop and Nation of Islam in America. And they'll look to those links rather than, you know, Jay-Z to suggest that, no, this is a form of music that is, you know, sort of indigenous to us to some degree.
So what is Palestinian hip-hop like?
It's very good. In fact, I'd argue that a couple of Palestinian bands, specifically Damn and Ramallah Underground, are two of the best hip-hop bands, or at least underground hip-hop bands, working today. نازل بلعب في الريموت بدي يعرف ايش عدد الموت هون مش سامع ولا الصوت اتس التليفون اسأل لانه ولا حد سائل سواء سياسي او دبلوماسي قاعدين على الكراسي وبتحدثوا بروحوا بحطوا روسهم وبتمددوا والبيوت في لبنان وغزة عم بتهدفوا اجا الوقت نفع بابوس لكل العالم لانه راح يضلوا يحكي وعمره ما حيعمل فايش بدنا نضلنا نقنع ونستنى بتمنى بس عالفاضي من زمان نسيوا عنا صعب تمسك حالك لما تشوف قدامك اللي قامك واللي شالك مش مستغرب اذا افكار جهنمية عم بتدور في بالك نازل بتنادي على الدنيا بس الدنيا نامت وحتى اذا قامت ما حتسمع كلامك ما حتسمع كلامك هون يوم معاك مية عذيك حواجز حواليك furious. Their flow is amazing. Their beats are good for the fact that they're not, you know, mixed by million-dollar producers. It's very, very good stuff.
What do they rap about? What are their lyrics like?
It starts and ends with the occupation. So these are political bands to the extreme. But surprisingly, there's a lot more nuance in their music than you'd find in your average sort of leftist Palestinian rhetoric. They speak a lot about the social problems in Arab-Israeli towns like Lod or Ramla, which are very tough towns. They speak about drug problems. They speak about crime. They speak about a lot of stuff that you just, kitchen sink drama type stuff that you just don't hear outside of the context of the occupation.
Hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I wondered reading about some of your trips is this cultural transmission so far seems to be pretty much a one-way street. So you've got kids in the Middle East who are listening to American music and being inspired, but, you know, Indonesian punk and Egyptian heavy metal is not making it on radio playlists in the U.S.
One of the things that I'm endlessly surprised about is, you know, we keep on being told that the internet has opened things up, globalization, blah, 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 idea exchange and so on. But I'm always a little astonished at how the conversation is so one way. We are not as curious in North America as I've always thought we should be. It's a little sad, I think. You know, you think of George Harrison bringing back the sitar from India back in the 60s. It just isn't that level of interest anymore. And I think there's something paradoxical about the internet in that it stifles curiosity to some extent. You know, the world's getting smaller, but people aren't traveling to places like Indonesia to look for new sounds anymore.
How does this American cultural transmission, how does this play out between the generations in some of these Middle Eastern countries? Because a lot of what you're talking about is exactly why, well, it's one of the reasons we're fighting the wars we're fighting in the Middle East, you know, because Muslim fundamentalists are reacting against American pop culture.
It's almost as if a lot of the countries that I visited are cut almost by like a cross. And one of the big rifts is generational. It's massive. And because there are so many more young people in these countries than old people, it's a massive, massive rift. What a lot of these countries are going through is pretty much an argument between old and new. How do we move forward when, you know, this part of our culture is physically and I guess culturally dying? And how do all these new young people and all these new young ideas mesh? These conversations are enormously fraught in these cultures, and they're enormously dangerous. The other fault line is, of course, religion. But I wonder, I wonder still if the generational conflict isn't the one that will bring a number of these countries to their knees much quicker than the religious one.
Yeah, that's a point really worth making. I must say I was really surprised in your book to read that the average age in most of the countries you visited was far younger than I would have expected.
In a country like Yemen, we're talking an average age of less than 20, which is almost unimaginable in countries as old as the States or Canada. As old, I mean, age-wise. Yeah, it's a real, real issue. It's a social issue that is, it couldn't be larger.
Well, you think about what happened to the U.S., the massive cultural transformation that the U.S. went through in the 60s when
exactly.
The baby boomers came of age, hit 16, 17, 18. Are we looking at something similar happening in the Middle Eastern world?
I think we are, yeah. I think where the real social explosion is going to happen is when a lot of these kids come of age, they look forward and understand that their countries are, to some degree, in their own hands. And it's not a change that's going to happen overnight, and it is a change that's happening, especially in countries like Egypt. There is a changeover going, it's bubbling under the surface, and no one quite knows how it's going to play out. But it will certainly play out, or at least a number of these battles will be fought on the culture battlefield.
Well, in the meantime, for an 18-year-old who's living in Afghanistan or Libya or Palestine, how much courage does it take? Does it amount to an act of bravery on their part to, say, join a band, play hip-hop or heavy metal or punk rock?
Yeah, it's very difficult for us over here to understand. And I feel myself even dull to it after having been away for a year or so. It is so dangerous in some of these countries to get involved in some of the subcultures that these kids choose. It really is looked down upon, certainly by the religious establishment, by the political establishment, and by their parents and their elders. It is an enormous challenge to identify yourself as a heavy metal in Iran, so much so that a lot of these kids' lives are tragic on account of it. I mean, all they want is to be able to rock out. It's essential to their sense of individuality, and the notion that this is being stifled. It was, especially in a place like Iran, certainly in Afghanistan, and in Egypt as well. It was just tragic how much these kids just wanted to be left alone to rock out, and that wasn't going to happen.
That's interesting, because I was wondering what happens when all these kids grow up and, as you said, take control of their country. Will they wind up feeling much more sympathetic to America and American interests because they grew up watching American sitcoms and playing American rock music?
Well, at base, they'll know a lot more about American culture than Americans would know about their culture, for one thing. I mean, they understand the rhythm of how our lives work. Just by watching a sitcom, I guess, to some degree, you get a notion of suburban culture. Now, of course, it's a warped notion. And as a South African, when I came over to North America, I was a little stunned at how things actually play out. There's always a culture shock difference. But yeah, I think encoded in a lot of pop culture are some really, really beautiful ideas and some really, natively American ideas, that sense of American optimism, that sense of beautiful individuality linked to community. And I don't think it's a bad thing that those ideas are being exported to these countries.
Richard Poplack is the author of The Sheikh's Batmobile, In Pursuit of American Pop Culture in the Muslim World.